The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, I meet Danish director Lone Scherfig to discuss the challenges of adapting the best-selling novel One Day, starring Anne Hathaway. And Pedro Almodovar is back with a striking twist on gender and on Pulp Fiction. I'll be speaking to the star of his film, The Skin I Live In, actress Elena Anaya. And Zam Brooks will be along as we review some of this week's other releases, including Clashing Swords and Throbbing Biceps with Conan the Barbarian, a Danish prison movie, and Final Destination 5. Yes, 5, finally. It's the best-selling podcast. It's Film Weekly.
Of course, you know, it's St. Swithin's Day today, don't you?
Hmm? What is?
Not today. St. Swithin's Day, the 15th of July.
How do you know that?
Well, he was buried in Winchester Cathedral, which is where I went to school.
Well, la-di-da.
La-di-da. You know, there's a poem. If on St. Swithin's Day at the Thrain, something, something, something remain.
Damn, that's beautiful. Sleep.
Anne Hathaway as Emma and Jim Sturgis as Dexter, there in a scene from One Day, a screen adaptation written by the best-selling novelist himself, David Nichols, telling the story of Emma and Dexter as we visit them each St. Swithin's Day over 20 years to chart their, and I suppose our, progress over the 90s and the noughties. The film is directed by Lone Scherfig, whose Oscar-nominated An Education was proof that a Danish director could bring quintessentially English manners to the big screen. So, when I met up with Lone here in London, I started out by asking her what kept drawing her back to Britain to make her films.
The writers are good, the actors are good, the craftsmanship is excellent. You have such a great film community here with a tradition of people who can do the most complicated, difficult things, but people who can also tell simple stories on a small budget. You have both traditions and a lot of kindness and humor.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
good
because
locations.
I didn't even, because you were working on Red Road with Andrea Arnold as well. You were kind of part of the creative process behind that film.
Yes,
as well.
But that's very much her project.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not going to give that one.
I'm not going to take credit for it. I think it's a wonderful film.
But your involvement is kind of pretty much here in with the British film industry, which kind of I think is extraordinary, given that there's so much creativity in the Danish film industry at the moment. I spoke to Suzanne Beer last week, a former colleague of yours, or I suppose still a colleague of yours at Zentropa, part of the Dogma 95 movement. Do you think that working in that environment has now given you the tools you need to go abroad, to go into a wider world?
It might be, but I do think that it's also experience. It's the fact that I've worked for a lot of years, but still have worked in that Dogma community that makes me able to make sometimes fast decisions, which you have, for instance, in One Day, where you have so many different locations. So it's a combination of both having a craft that you can use, but also wanting to make sure that that there's an aspect of life that you don't over control, but that you can rely on experience with the actors too. I think when you do something that you want to be humorous and real, it is a good thing to have been to Dogma land, where authenticity plays such an important role.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very interesting that given that An Education and One Day, which sort of come together, I suppose, if you look at your work right at the end of your career, you come back and say, well, I did a period where I did these films which are very much about British class, British society in a way.
Hopefully it's not over yet.
No, I'm saying that, but you know, at some point you'll go on to do different things as well. But these two are going to get compared and contrasted. And so did you go for One Day yourself? Were you asked on board to One Day, having seen what you did with a literary property with An Education? Did they say, well, let's get her back? Or was it something that you pursued yourself?
I had worked with Focus Features previously and before An Education, actually. And it's a very director-oriented, quality-oriented American company, but they are based, or a lot of it is based here in London. And last year, of course, they did a lot of British films. And they you just have a very rich culture and a very rich language.
Oh,
and
good.
Architecture. And it's that should make it harder, but in a way it's easier because it's fascinating. It's like when you travel, you suddenly open your eyes and look at things you would normally never notice when you're at home. And and there's a discipline
But I remember when
I spoke
to you about education.
I don't think one more film. I think I'm going to keep working here for longer.
Oh, right, okay.
I
really, if we'll have you.
Yes, that's...
if selected. But I remember talking to you about an education loaner and the sort of response that you were giving at that time was, well, yeah, we were like, well, why is a Danish woman kind of detail the 60s in Britain? It was a very specific kind of time and era that you didn't have any clue about because you were too young to have been there even. But now the 80s and 90s of Britain, the 2000s of Britain, it is something you know. You used to say that you could bring a foreigner's eye to a culture. I'm wondering, the more you work here, the less foreign you are, or the less foreign we seem to you, perhaps. Was it easier on one day or harder because you actually sort of understand us a bit more?
I think maybe it's more important to bring a foreigner's ear, because I listen. I have to listen to the people who know much more about this than I do. So there is no false sense of security, and I didn't have that with an education. I knew that in order to get it right, I wanted to rely on the people around me and get the best out of whatever the synergy this fantastic crew can bring onto the project. And I think there's necessarily any advantage in being a foreigner. Not when I did an education either. but I do thank you for thinking that I wasn't alive when that film happened, because
just about, you were little.
Let's I was, it. Yeah.
I looked it
but
up.
Of course, one day is closer in terms of culture,
yeah,
and the period,
too, yeah.
The 90s and the last decade, where I mean, I had years where I did things that are very similar to what you see Emma and Dexter do, the detours they take in their youth, the things they shouldn't have done, the serial monogamy.
Can
that
I? You're
follow.
A filmmaker, obviously, and this tends to be sort of the domain of someone, I suppose, a little bit bookish in a way, someone a bit geeky. Were you a geeky girl? Were you like Emma in the way that you had glasses, or were you always cool as you are now?
I was and am as insecure and overcompensating as Emma. I also have some of Dexter's being too relaxed, underestimating how hard life can be, relying on luck. They develop very differently, and I do recognize myself in both of them. I definitely recognize Emma's love for Dexter because he is just such an attractive man. Mm-hmm. But
have you had crushes on people just
but
because
I was,
they're attractive?
I was a writer, if you like Emma Morley.
Exactly,
and
that's what I thought.
Still am. My native language is better than my English. I know it doesn't sound very believable that I write, but I can recognize myself within her in a lot of people can.
Yeah,
luckily.
No, well, I think that's why everyone falls in love with the book. We all recognise bits of ourselves. I recognise bits of myself in Emma Morley as well, even though I've never been a girl at any stage of my life. And I confess that to you now. do you have, I know One Day's only out, but do you have a next film plan? Are you going back to Denmark? You staying here? Going to Hollywood?
I hope I'm just going to go right around the corner from here in London, but I don't know what's going to happen next. I should make and be like Emma Morley and not take unnecessary detours and really try and think and enjoy this film and see it to the door.
Well, whatever happens with this one, I don't think we'll see you working in a Mexican restaurant off the Blackstock Road at any
oh,
point.
Oh, thanks. That's a relief.
But before I go, Luna Shipping, I want to ask the music that kind of takes us through the film. Have you got one favourite track from One Day, one that really chimes with you?
I think our end track, Elvis Costello's song, Sparkling Day, is simple and beautiful, and he's embellished it in a way I think is really beautiful, and something that comes with experience, that you dare just be generous and use effects that are take out elements from his toolbox, percussion particularly, that just is lovely to use and not too pretentious and full of warmth. It's such a beautiful song. But there was no message from me.
and Lona Scherfig's One Day goes on UK-wide release from this Friday, the 26th of August. Now, me and Zan Brooks meet one day a week. I think we've got deep romantic currents in what
we're
do.
We're destined for each other, Jason.
I think so.
Both of us, for some reason, are resisting.
Will you be adopting a Yorkshire come Liverpool come Pakistani accent?
Will you be dabbling in TV and flying too high,
youth culture,
too close to the sun?
I think we know which way the parts would have gone were we cast in it, Zan, don't you? Zan, we'll be looking at One Day, of course. We'll also be looking at Conan the Barbarian with a new Arnie, Jason Momoa. And it's the year of Jason's, I think, isn't it? We've got some more Danish stuff, our hit first, hit hardest. And then we can talk about Almodovar and The Skin I Live In. But let's start, I think, with One Day, because we just heard from Lona Scherfig there. Were you a fan of it?
I was a fan of An Education. I thought it was a very nimble navigation of Lynn Barber's memoir. Here you've got a book that perhaps carries more baggage. It's the David Nichols novel. It's a sort of better-known book. It's a bestseller. It's almost kind of ubiquitous. It's deeply loved by the people who've read it. And so anybody filming it, I think, is almost predestined to disappoint.
Yeah, I mean, that is the nature of filming books, isn't it?
Absolutely. There's a problem in that I found the supporting characters almost to be more interesting than the central duo.
That's what you said about the sort of process of filmmaking, is that those with shorter screen time don't have to fill out flesh out their characters.
Yeah, so you've got Rafe Spall as Anne Hathaway's boyfriend. You've got Romola Garay, who's always great, as supposedly the sort of pinched, unsympathetic wife. And yet, in a way, is almost more sympathetic than I found Anne Hathaway. And that's a sort of key problem with the film for me. And it also meant that when the film was focusing on the two characters leading separate lives and struggling with their own issues, I found it almost more rewarding than when they were kind of thrown together in the sort of will they, won't they. I almost didn't care about that so much.
Yeah, which you do in the book.
I think you do,
Very strangely. I mean, the book is not something that I would have loved or read, and I really fell in love with the book. I really enjoyed it. I think it's deceptively genius, the book, to be honest. Yeah. And the film isn't really deceptively genius. I don't think it's a terrible film,
though. No, it's not. It's a sort of mixtape, really. It's a sort of mixtape of moments.
It's very funny
some
that
of those
you
moments
that.
Work and some don't.
It's funny that you mention that, because that's what they gave out as a sort of publicity promo material, a mixtape, with some of the songs that were in the film, and some of the material was like a hard driving mixtape, like an actual CD. What do you call it?
No, I'm not on that mailing screen. List.
You're not on that right list. That's what they gave us. It was all a bit like a cassette player. That's the word.
Do
you remember them? So there was a mixtape kind of thing going on, and I think you've exactly nailed it. That's kind of, I like a mixtape, but sometimes they get chewed up.
Sometimes they get chewed up and you want to skip certain bits of it.
Yeah. That's One Day by Lona Scherfig, starring Anne Hathaway and Jim Sturgis. Zan, accents abound in Conan the Barbarian, although I'm not sure where on earth that they're supposed to be. Jason Momoa takes the part of Conan, formerly played by Arnie, of course. Here he is, searching for the bandit who killed his father.
My people were slain by a common bandit, not a king.
He's a bandit then. He's a legend now, a shadow lord.
The Shadow Lord, huh? Speak. I will not kill you.
You know the Forbidden Forest.
Nothing there but dead bodies and the animals who feed on them.
Even as we speak, Kala leads his legions through the mist.
Not good enough.
Now, Zan, I'm all oiled up and showing you my pecs. Do I match up to the Jason Momoa?
No one matches up to Jason Momoa. Not even Arnie Schwarzenegger, who, of course, we remember from the Conan films of old,
John
back
Milius.
In the 80s. The John Milius films, yeah. I guess memories have now faded enough for Conan to be wheeled out of retirement. And
let's go back to those originals. Were they any good? I mean, I watched them.
I haven't
VHS.
Seen them since I was a teenager.
Yeah,
I
exactly.
Think. Rather worryingly, I do remember reading the Marvel comic adaptations.
You've got more comics than I can I give you.
Yeah,
every
it's
time
quite worrying,
these things
isn't
come
it?
Up, you
I
go,
know,
"Well,
that's
I used my, to read
that's
comic.
My
I've
reference.
Got a big pile of them."
Yeah, that's
You're
my
a bit
reference.
Weirder than I thought you were.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm still out there, and I really enjoyed those. For very dubious reasons, which the film kind of honours.
They had a lot of women in bear skins.
They did. They had a lot of kind of naked slaves.
Yeah, this is not dubious. This is completely understandable.
And there's nothing that a lonely teenage boy wants or desires more than a buff naked slave.
You're not going to sell your comic collection. I would say that perhaps it is soiled, Zan, and we will not be able to sell this collection. But anyway,
and this is
thought.
Very much in the tradition of that.
The producer's slapping his head. He's like, I can't use that. You're using that. It's funny.
And you've also got the kind of what noted scholars, I guess, refer to as gore porn, where limbs are sort of hacked off and stumps jet blood across the screen. Yeah. And there's lots of, slow motion clanking and a lot of dialogue that I genuinely couldn't hear. Yeah. Because it's buried under this thunderous roar of maidens being defiled and blades
crashing. They also kind of early, you know, did you watch Armstrong and Miller where they do that kind of, I'm going to get mammoth, I'm going to buy mammoth. Yeah. That's kind of where we are with the dialogue in this.
Yeah, and you've also got the terrible hoary narrator as well, who comes in every now and again saying, "The land that time
is it Morgan
forgot.
Freeman or is it more than Freeman?"
I think it's more
I
than
think
Freeman.
That guy off
it's
the
more than Freeman plus. And you know, of course, it's utterly ludicrous, and that's fine, I guess, if you like the Conan myth. Mm. That's entirely what you're requiring, and yet it fatally overstays its welcome.
Yes,
it just goes on, and it's an endless battle followed by an endless battle. And Jason Momoa is, you know, we're told that he's got the heart of a king and the loyalty of a bloodhound, but he just looks like this peevish jock, kind of, you know, waddling around, looking slightly bemused
it's
about
really
where he
weird,
is.
Isn't it? Because he just does look like an American person. I know they're supposed to be, I don't know where it is, Samaria and all of that.
It's a land that time forgot.
It is. But he just looks like, you know, some bloke from the gym.
Yeah, he does.
I don't
yeah.
even go to a gym, but I'm sure that's what they look like.
It's what they look like, and you don't mess with them.
No, you don't.
I did like Rose McGowan as the sort of witch queen.
In what way did you like her? She had a shaven head, a sort of black monobrow.
Well, my tastes have become much more sophisticated since my teenage years, and now I like the shaven headed look. I just thought she was having fun with it in a way that the others sort of weren't.
She did play up the camp. I mean, in a way, she's Roberta Rodriguez kind of graduate. I think still girlfriend. I'm not sure.
I think so, yeah.
And they obviously had a laugh with this because she did that in his films, that sort of over the top zombie movie that she was in. Mm. And she sort of was still in that mode. And I thought, well, that's the right thing. But everyone else was playing it straight.
Everyone's playing it straight and just looking faintly irritable, but they weren't quite sure whether they were getting it right.
Now, this Conan the Barbarian, we're going on about it, Conan the Barbarian in a way. It's yet another superhero movie from this summer that stars someone in the main role who I sort of don't really know. We had the Green Lantern, it was Ryan Reynolds, okay, we know him. Captain America, never heard of that bloke. The guy was Thor, never heard of him. The guy's Conan, never heard. What's happened to these are big tentpole movies. They're trying to launch them without stars. It seems to be failing.
I mean, I guess they get them for cheap, and then you can spend more money on the CGI sand monsters and the things like that. I didn't know him either, although apparently he is in Game of Thrones, which has been screening, which I haven't seen.
Producer, again, loves a bit of Game of Thrones.
And previous to that, he was on Baywatch.
Oh, was he?
He was, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was he Pamela Anderson's left breast? I've seen him before.
I think he was the buttock.
Ah, that's why. You wouldn't know. Poor old Jason Momoa. We shall not look upon his like again, I don't think.
Until Conan the Destroyer.
Oh, is that what number two is?
Yeah.
Zan, hit first, hit hardest. There we were talking to Lone Scherfig about Danish explosion. Here is a Danish prison movie. Perhaps exactly what you need. R stands for Rune, because that's the name of the prisoner.
That's the name of the prisoner. Hit First, Hit Hardest is an unfortunate title to have when we've had Un Prophet and Cell 211. This is like the sort of sidekick who piles in once the real damage has been done and just aims a few kicks and rifles
so
the pockets.
We're all, like, you can see them all packing up, we're finished, actually, yeah. Rune. It's like, oh, I'm still fighting in prisons.
And this, you know, like Un Prophet opens with the callow young inmate being ushered in and made to strip and be searched and then being recruited by the badass gang boss inside the prison. So this follows the exact same route. And so you've got Run, who is in for stabbing someone, gets kind of keel-hauled into to performing a hit in prison. I'm not using the lingo very well, am I? You know, you can tell I've never been in a prison
well,
in my life.
It seems to me that it's very difficult to describe for a critic, because either you use the lingo of the prison
of
drama.
The screws.
Sort of say screws, offing, you know, ghosting.
Snaps.
And all that. Snaps, give me some salmon, whatever. And, you know, now or you just can't do it. You just can't say, well, of course he performs a bolt fuss.
I know. I would just lock myself in the cell if I was there. I just would never. I'd never go into the yard. That's what I learned from these things. Never go in the yard.
Never go in the yard.
Stairwell's
or the showers.
Just as bad. Showers. There's a whole horror show in the showers.
There really is. I mean, as you say, we see a profit. Cell 211. Sort of the sliding scale of not so good. Even the British films this year, we've had Ghosted and Screwed as well.
Yeah.
This one, for me, sort of comes in right at the end. I mean, hit last.
I don't know. I didn't dislike it.
I don't mind a prison movie.
Yeah, I almost wondered whether you have to almost consciously attempt to louse up a prison movie where you have the callow young recruit who's recruited by the evil guys and has to do stuff and earn his spurs and then maybe starts rising through the ranks. There's an inbuilt drama to that, and it's all played out within the four walls, and there's that sense of menace that it's almost ready-made drama. And this worked for me. It was absolute old rope. I'd seen it 100 times before, and we'll probably see it again. And yet, against the odds, I found myself getting involved.
Oh, well, that's interesting, because I thought it was a bit grim and dull looking as well.
That's prisons for you, though, isn't it? What do you want? Musicals?
It shouldn't be fun, should it? It should be locked up, all of these people. Maybe it should be shown to rioters and looters and all that sort of mob.
They need something to watch.
Perhaps they should watch Final Destination 5.
Right here in the statement, I saw it collapse. I knew it would happen. That sounds premeditated to me.
No. That's not what I meant. I had a vision.
Okay. A vision. Psychic phenomena. Ghosts. Bigfoot. You actually believe in that stuff?
I don't know.
I'll tell you what I believe. There's an answer for everything, which means there's an answer for why you knew to warn everyone the bridge was going to collapse. And minutes later, it did.
I told you, I saw it coming. I don't know how. I just did.
Have you seen any of the Final Destination?
I have seen the Final Destination films, and the ones I've seen, and surprisingly enough, they do slightly blur, I have enjoyed.
Do you know what? Do you remember the premise then?
I do remember the premise.
Which is that
death comes a calling.
Yes, because I would not stop for death. He kindly stopped for me. I kept thinking of Emily Dickinson.
That was the inspiration,
and I'm not quite sure that this was anything that the filmmakers ever considered, but it does sort of, because you miss out on a mass accident, and then death, if you're the lucky survivors, and then death kind of goes, you're not going to escape me.
You're not quoting from Emily Dickinson anymore.
No, not at this moment. Okay. No, the Hour of Lead and all of that. I saw a fly when I... So death comes after them in this kind of amazing kind of Honda advert, Fishley and Vice kind of installation, kind of ineluctable mechanism. And I mean, every time someone walks into a room, you know, something will shake and you think, oh, everything is fraught with danger.
Yeah.
And the opening credit sequence of this film just had loads of household objects kind of flying towards you in 3D, kind of shattering a glass. And when it finished, the audience that I saw it with stood up and cheered.
Really?
They cheered and opened
these
credits.
These are critics.
Some of them were critics, and some of them I'd not
were
seen.
Paid but for but by the of, distributor.
No, some of them were sort of film fans and bloggers and all of that.
Yeah.
But they love this stuff. And it struck me as I was watching it, and there is sort of beauty to these things, that the death sequences in these films have become like dance routines. Mm. You want to kind of admire the choreography
sort
with
of
how people...
Busby Berkeley is the Grim Reaper,
yeah,
isn't it?
Exactly. It's really... I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It was great. No stars in it at all,
yeah,
because they're all going to get killed in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
There's no point. You just kind of play which one's going to go first. Kind of old-fashioned. And I think it's quite good.
Okay.
I've got to say, it's always really good, actually.
Really?
I laugh at the kind of death climaxes, but they are outré. I mean, one woman dies having her laser eye surgery, and then, you know, the final bit, the eye just kind of rolls out of her head and gets run over by a truck. And it's like, everyone went, oh, that's brilliant. There is a sort of tastelessness that's just delicious.
Are you binging on junk ahead of the Venice Film Festival?
Yeah, I'm hoping that maybe many of the nights will be like that. Especially WE by Madonna.
Yeah, there's going to be some 3D death scenes in that.
I think definitely. Zan, talking of surgery, we must finish with perhaps the film of the week, if we're being sensible. Pedro Almodovar's The Skin I Live In. We'll be hearing from its star, the beautiful Elena Anaya. I had the pleasure of meeting that lady after we review The Skin I Live In. Because we talked about it in Cannes when we first saw it and said that this could be possible. Pedro could come in at the end and win
it
off Malik and stuff. is it, where is it in the Pedro Almodovar kind of canon? Because he's got such a large cannon, if I may put
it
that way.
Yeah, and he's not afraid to shoot it off.
Isn't he?
The weird thing about this film is that I think it's oddly disappointed at a lot of Almodovar diehard devotees. I mean, you could break his career into almost two periods, I guess. You've got the wild, bawdy romps of the early years, and then you've got these mature, swooning, lustrous
films.
So you've
got the Women on the Verge, you've got the Bellucci bombs.
Yeah,
you've got
then you've got Volver and All About My Mother and Broken Embraces, which are the sort of the more mature, but you know,
reflective, less hysterical.
Yeah, and this is sort of separate again, I think, in that it is wild, it is transgressive, and yet it's probably the most tightly plotted film that he's ever done. I mean, it's a high concept thriller in a way. It's got a little bit of Georges Franju's Eyes Without a Face in there. It's got a lot of Hitchcock in there.
He's got a bit obsessed with Hitchcock because Broken Embraces happens if it was all Hitchcock.
Yeah, but this basically pivots on a twist that comes sort of maybe two thirds of the way through the film. So the first chunk of it is a brilliantly managed tease where you're not quite sure where you are and what's going on.
What does he tease us with?
The tease is that you've got Antonio Banderas making his first film with Almodovar for 20-odd years, playing this deranged plastic surgeon who's shunned by the establishment. And we think he's a widower, but then there's a woman that he's kept locked up in his house that he's experimenting on, who may well be his wife, who we thought had perished in a car crash. And in the meantime, he's also on a mission of vengeance against this young buck who assaulted his daughter. But nothing is quite as it seems, and you're led through this hall of mirrors, and then the trap is sprung, and it's brilliantly done.
It's a literal hall of mirrors as well. I mean, you're saying that in your time-honored phrase for kind of tricks and box trick, but there's a lot of mirror play in it, and there's a housekeeper in the kind of Rebecca kind of style.
Yeah, and I guess the point of it all is that. Identity is a construct, and gender is a construct as well, and it's superbly managed. Possibly it's a little too machine tooled, a little bit too cold, but within that, it's brilliantly played by Banderas.
I liked it. It was great seeing him
first. Great role he's had in, you know, maybe since he left Spain.
Do you think it's because at last he's speaking Spanish again?
And maybe so.
And I can understand him with the help of subtitles, obviously, but he just seems so much comfier in the role.
Yeah, and it's all about withholding. You know, it's now a Almodovar film, so you might expect people to be slightly over the top and flamboyant, but Banderas gives a brilliantly restrained, chilly, cold performance.
Handsome chap, isn't he?
And yeah, he's looking great at, you know, 50 or whatever. You know, and he's had no plastic surgery, so
he gave it all to his wife.
There you go,
And Elena Anaya, who was in Sex and Lucia.
Yeah, is the mystery woman in the room.
In the room.
I thought this was great, really.
It's good stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
But isn't it sort of, what's extraordinary about Almodovar, for all the canon that we talked about, is that once it starts, there's just no one else it could be.
Absolutely. No, he's a complete one-off. And yes, he's cherry-picking from loads of different sources. You know, it's basically a psychosexual Frankenstein story, this. And so he's quite open about references and borrowing and plagiarism, I guess. And yet, he spins it completely into his own work.
Yeah.
You know, I can't really understand people who aren't responding to this as well as they should. I thought it was a terrific film.
I think there's a lot of art in it. There's a lot of magpieing. There's a lot of references. Yeah. There's a lot of kind of setups. There's kind of delicious details. But it is very confusing. I mean, it just goes, as you say, that final bit, it kind of veers all across the road, like on a mountain pass, and you just don't know where it's going to go.
But it pays off.
Personally, I think it doesn't. Personally, I think it's, I sort of was, my jaw was dropping, kind of, he's not going to do that, is he? No one in their right mind would do it. As I say, it's, you know, you would never run it past a Hollywood kind of script factory kind of committee of producers. You have to be your own man in your own production company with only your brother to kind of bounce things off and say, well, I'm going to do that, fuck it.
Yeah.
And he can
and he does, and thank God that he does.
Pedro Almodovar's The Skin I Live In, presumably your film of the week.
Oh, easy, yeah.
Thanks to Zan, as ever, and for all of Zan's reviews and some of his book podcasts. Oh, yes. Go to guardian.co.uk/film. As you heard there, Zan and I were taken with Antonio Banderas' co-star Elena Anaya in The Skin I Live In. She's part of the Almodovar ensemble of Spanish and Latin American actors, putting in a striking performance as the cage bird Vera. I'm happy to report that during this year's Cannes Film Festival, I managed to catch up with the beautiful Elena to discuss her leading role in The Skin I Live In.
Estoy hecha a tu medida. Y acabas de decirme que te gusto.
He dicho eso.
Elena, congratulations on The Skin I Lived In. Working with Pedro Almodovar, you did it, of course, before in Talk to Her. Did he call you back, or was it something you've been trying to persuade him to take you for a few films?
No, I don't persuade anybody in my life, and minimum unless a director. And unless a director as Pedro. He called me from his production company, El Desire, and I was like, wow, thrilled, you know, like speechless when I heard about the possibility of being in the film. And after some auditions, one audition actually, he gave me the part.
Yeah, and you knew what it was going to be. Did he try you with the skin? Did he say, here's the skin, fit that, and you can have the part?
Well, we had because the skin is not something material that you can get in like a suit. We did an audition for three scenes, and very specific scenes, very important scenes, and with many indications that he gave me, and it was quite easy.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what sort of director he is then. You've worked with him once before. What is he like? He's very specific, he gives you very strict instructions, or he lets you be free?
You know, he knows very well his characters, almost like a projection of himself. And he can guide you to the most amazing weird places that the character leave, you know? So the indications that he gives constantly, they are very correct, very crazy, and very effective to drive you inside the character.
He's a very particular sort of filmmaker, really. I don't know anyone else who can do such changes within the same scene, within the same plot. Mm-hmm. And he knows exactly where he can take his humour. But as an actress, I wonder how you know. You have to trust him, I suppose, with what if it's going to be funny, if it's going to be tragic, if it's sexy, if it's sad. There's so many shifts in tone. How do you deal with them?
You know, Pedro told me the first time we met for this film. He told me, I know how good an actress you are, and I know you can play this role. And I was like, okay, let's try, let's see. But what is most important for me is that you understand me. And I said, let's try. And I understood him quite well. But when he directs you and he gives you the indications, he gives you the indications that he believes they are the correct ones. Not because he wants to provoke love, or he wants to provoke another kind of emotions. He gives you the directions that he considers they are the precise ones.
Yeah. Working with Pedro is obviously having a great effect on Spanish actresses. We know from Penelope Cruz how well her career is around the world. We know from Paz Vega as well, who you work with in Sex and Lucia, the international career that Spanish actresses now have. We're talking in English now. I know you've done French films for Fred Cavaillé, and you were in Mesrine with Vincent Cassel. It seems that there's a new generation of Spanish actresses, which are a part that is having a very interesting international career.
You know, I think the barriers are disappearing in an artistic way, but not only in my country. I think in all the countries. But it's true, you know, you need to speak a little bit languages, and I want to improve my accents and my languages.
That's why we're doing this interview. It's really just look at it as a learning exercise.
Oh, that's good. No, I take it like also like an exercise for me. But it's true that it can open, you know, the opportunities and the possibilities to work in other countries.
And I'm sure when Elena brushes up her language skills and accents, she'll take Hollywood by storm. Pedro Almodóvar's The Skin I Live In is on UK-wide release from this Friday, the 26th of August. And for the video version of that interview, where she's beautiful and obviously I am too, you can check out the excellent Cinemoi website, cinemoi.tv. You know you want to. Excellent film channel. That's all we have for you this week. The very beautiful music we've been featuring in the show is the original score to The Skin I Live In by longtime Almodóvar collaborator, composer Alberto Iglesias. Beautiful stuff. Well worth checking out. All of his stuff, in fact, is well worth checking out. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye, and I'll see you in Venice next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.